You're listening to UnConcast on the Georgia Podcast Network, featuring unconference sessions and other related discussions from around the Southeast. Welcome. This is Teaching an Old Dog, New Tricks, Podcasting, and Traditional Media. My name's Rusty Tanton. I'm one of the co-organizers of PodCamp and also co-founded the Georgia Podcast Network, along with Amber Ray, who is the one of the lead organizers of PodCamp. We're just here to talk about some of the relationships between new media and old media, and a lot of us are sort of looking at the business models of what traditional media is doing, and we see a lot of problems, and we think there's going to be a vacuum, and I think all of us are kind of asking, what's that vacuum going to be filled with? And that's kind of what we want to center the discussion around. So I've got a couple of folks here who are old media hands. who are going to sort of lead the discussion. And they also, I'll just let them introduce themselves. You want to go ahead and do that?
Thanks, Rusty. My name is Doug Monroe. I'm they keep saying old in conjunction with me, but I've worked with United Press International, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Atlanta Magazine, and Creative Loafing. And now I'm a freelance writer in Atlanta, and I do a blog for Atlanta Magazine called Peachtree Screed, and I also do a print column once a month called The Monroe Doctrine. I've had an interesting experience with the mainstream media, the old traditional media. Every place I worked in the last 10 years, I was chewed out. I was called on the carpet for looking at the internet while I was at work. And so that has evolved a great deal in just the last couple of years. I went from being chewed out from looking at too many blogs, or wasting my time, so to speak, by looking at blogs, because the newspaper managers did not see that as the function of a reporter reading, getting information off blogs and the internet. But now, in the last couple of years, every media outlet I'm familiar with, the traditional media, they've had a big magic moment where the editor or publisher comes in and says, okay, now we are all bloggers. We've got blog fever. Catch it. And that happened, that's happened at the AJC, and it's happened at Creative Loafing, and then Atlanta Magazine hired me freelance to do a blog, basically as a part-timer. And I'll pass it over to Grace and Daughters.
Thank you, Doug. I began my career in mainstream media working for ABC News as an associate producer here in the Southeast. Worked there for about 6 years and then worked in corporate communications for the Home Depot for a long time, for about 10 years. My entire background is nothing but mainstream media, working for the man. But when the internet came along, I got very involved initially by creating a chat room for Melrose Place back in the mid-90s, and it's pretty much, I've been gone on the internet ever since. And it got to the point where when I was laid off from Home Depot, I started freelancing and became more, and I started blogging at that point. I decided, well, maybe I should go back to mainstream media, and last year about this time, I was offered a very nice position at a state entity, at a government entity, and my job description was to produce a show for them, a video show, because that's my background, video production, and to, quote, further new media. They had no idea what they were getting into when they told me to go further new media. So I was, I jumped in onto that, said, great, sounds like the perfect job for me. About 2 months later, my boss pulled me into her office and said, you've got to stop surfing the net. And this was just last year. She said, we don't do that here. I said, but you hired me to further new media. I don't care. Stop surfing the net. And so I went home and emailed in my resignation. I could tell that was not the place for me. I don't know if I have a home in mainstream media anymore. I've gone so down the tubes, so to speak, that I don't know if I'm ever coming back. I don't know if I want to. So anyway, but if you have questions about mainstream media and crossover and creating content in both environments, let me know.
I've got one observation is that in the existing media that's trying to figure out how to use the internet, I think a lot of the managers still view blogging as something that people should do in their spare time. Something that, okay, well, if you have time, get around to it, but do the print stuff first. The AJC is sort of going through a revolution right now. They're getting rid of all the old people, and now they're announcing that they're going to do a lot more online. They've had their public editor declared that they're all going to have to work a lot harder to do the print and the online, and they're revamping their newsroom. Basically, everybody down there apparently is going to have a blog. Weren't you saying, Grayson, that they're having a blog school?
Yeah, they went to blog school, apparently, a couple of weeks ago. I don't know exactly what they learned there, but I sure would like to have been in that session, their week-long session, how to blog. So they're now all going to be blogging for you. So.
And I think it's everybody down there. It's going to be like an orc army of bloggers coming at you. I go to the AJC website every day. The one blog that I really like is Political Insider. I think Galloway and Baxter do a good job. I do basically a news and politics blog. But I find the AJC website, to me, I go through it every day, is still a Tower of Babel. I don't get it. I still have a hard time navigating it. And I think all of the established print media are having a very difficult time figuring out what to do with it. Atlanta Magazine, for instance, started blogs. We started three blogs last fall. At that time, the magazine was getting about 10,000 unique visitors to their webpage per month. Since then, that's gone to 80,000, from 10,000 to 80,000. But there are no more ads. They're not commercializing that increase. And so I don't see many ads on the other websites that I look at. In the traditional media, we have a couple of people here from Creative Loafing. Some of my friends, I used to work there, and they're doing the web page. So I'd like to get them involved in the discussion about what they're doing if they'd like. But I think, from my point of view, I know in my own situation, Atlanta Magazine knew I was looking for work and asked if I'd like to do a blog, and I hadn't done one before, so I started it, and I consider myself very fortunate. But it's still sort of a part-time thing there, and I think the mainstream media, as they go about it, still look at it, blogging, as something that the writers do in their spare time. I could be wrong if somebody wants to disagree with me. Grayson?
Doug? Yes. I just wanted to interject something. Remember, Doug and Grayson, they're our presenters, and we are co-creators with them on this event right now. And we want to welcome your comments and questions. If you have them, call me over. I'll bring you the mic. Please introduce yourself. Tell us your website address or your company that you're working for, and we can create this together. Okay.
Well, I'm very grateful to you because this is the first presentation. Oh, I'm sorry. Julie Squires, fake podcaster. Actually, I own a company called SoftScribe, and we do technology PR. And yours is the first panel that I can really relate to. It seems to me that the real issue in, you know, the crossover between traditional and emerging media is that basically it's now direct to the consumer. PR Web has done that, and it's happening in other areas. So the blog or the podcast is just the vehicle. To me, podcasts are more interesting than blogs. Blog is just more text, it seems to me. And the world is getting really crowded. I mean, when you start signing up to all these blogs, it's not really helping our clients achieve their goals, which is mainly to increase sales and solidify their brands in the tech market.
Let me ask you this. So what if a blogger was blogging about your client's products? How would you feel about that?
It gets lost in the crowd.
Do people agree with that statement?
I'm open. Okay.
Well, I mean, Josh Hallett, Haiku. I mean, the blogosphere was not created to market your company's products. So that's like one of the sort of foundations. And I can't tell you how many times a PR firm comes to me and says, oh, you know Mike Arrington, you know all the different people in the Valley. Can you get our product listed? And I look at it, I'm like, it's not any good. So do you really want to put it out there because you're going to be, you know, killed in some way, shape, or form because the product isn't that good? That was speaking, kind of go back to the main point, though, is two different things I see. My clients are traditional media, New York Times papers and Tribune Media. We have a lot of reporters that are really embracing blogs, and they love it, and it's becoming a core focus of what they do every single day, and it's amazing. But the issues we're running into is, one is you've got a lot of bloggers within the traditional media that are adopting the tool and not the methodology. So a lot of the political blogs, I mean, I love to do this with some of the clients I've got. You know, I'll go to the paper and I'll say, so you're the political blogger. What are the top five political blogs in this state? And they'll say, I don't know. When was the last time you linked to another blog? When was the last time you commented on another blog? And they're like, we don't do that. And it's like, well, then you're not really doing what you're supposed to be doing. And the other thing is, from the top management standpoint, there's still this ethos that they report and then we converse. There's no, we don't converse with them. And it's kind of interesting, you know, to see how that has been developing and slowly changing. Like I said, there's some reporters that are doing a really great job. And the funny thing about them is they're building their own brands. And they're actually getting hired out of the newspapers because they have an individual brand. They have an individual voice.
Let me give you a really great example of what happened during Hurricane Katrina. I was pulled back in to work the ABC News assignment desk during Hurricane Katrina because obviously they needed help and under emergency circumstances. They did an amazing job of covering that hurricane. However, I was so internet dependent, and the traditional guys on the desk, they didn't read blogs. They didn't even read the other wire services. And I remember pulling something off of a blog about day three into the hurricane. All right, it may have come from AP. I think it was on an AP story, but they're so insular. They're so into that it's got to be the ABC brand. It has to come from ABC. It has to be driven by one of our massive satellite trucks to, you know, get to the people. We can't go outside of the ABC sphere to report this. But I pulled a story about, remember the rogue cops, and I think they've now been put on trial or will face trial. There were policemen in New Orleans who were misbehaving and doing horrible things and stealing products and essentially trying to commando the whole situation. Well, that first moved on an AP story, and it moved on some people that were blogging in New Orleans that were stuck there and were able to blog. And I put this in front of the assignment manager's desk. I said, you know, there's some really nasty circumstances going on with the New Orleans PD, according to these reports. They threw it in the trash. You know, they didn't give a rat's ass because it didn't come from one of their reporters in the field. They didn't want to hear about it. Well, you know, 2 months later, CNN did a very long investigative piece and, you know, brought these rogue cops to trial. They have now going to prosecute these policemen. But there was a story and a situation is if it doesn't come from them, if it doesn't come from their people, that meaning the ABC people on their payroll, it is not considered news. And that was a mindset just a year and a half ago.
Yeah, hi, I'm Patrick Gall. I have a blog called Ellie's Dad on Blogspot. I guess my question is, I have two thoughts. First, a comment on engagement. You know, it seems to me that large companies should be blogging to engage and to enter into, you know, dialogue with their clients, and that's really what it's about. And it's a wonderful free way to get, you know, immediate feedback. But the other thing is relative to old media versus new media. I mean, I can't remember the last time I bought a Wall Street Journal or the Atlanta Journal-Constitution or any traditional old media, anything, because I don't need to. You know, I get all of my information off the internet. I'm not reading that anymore. So, you know, are these guys driving trucks delivering blocks of ice and just don't realize refrigerators have been created? I mean, you know.
Murray Grievous, Creative Loafing. I just wanted to get back to her question, and I try to be a contrarian in these because it helps me as well. We never got back to what her issue was, and I would have to, we all said, oh, not me, but everyone said, oh, that's not true. But the last two comments have borne that out. If she, as a consultant, told her technology customer, yeah, you need to go on blogs, she'd be crazy. It doesn't matter if the product is the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's going to get hammered by somebody who hates it or just wants to be contrarian. Podcasting is, and that's what we're here for, well, mostly what we're here for today, is a much better way to go because you can, I hate, people are going to say, oh, we don't want to do this. But you control the presentation of it. And if people are looking for information, then that's what they're going to do. And people are laughing like, but, you know, there's a difference between commercialization of it and the free spirit of blogging. If someone is trying to make money on something and trying to present their product in the best way, putting it on a blog is not the best way to do it because it's going to get hammered. Putting it out in a podcast where you control it, people download it and listen to it, they can send in emails and such and so forth, is a much better way to do it. There's tons of companies out there that have done that. And to their discredit and their hate that they have done it, have tried to do stuff on blogs, and it almost always backfires on them.
I mean, I'll take an issue with that. I mean, I can point to hundreds of companies that I've dealt with that have done it right because they first and foremost listen to what their customers want, and they put a human face out there. So that when they do get hammered, it's, you know, sort of the traditional, you know, sort of trolls are out there. But the majority of the people that really love and embrace their product say, you know, yeah, I understand this guy's got a little issue with the product, but ultimately, because you're out there, you're talking with us, you're becoming one of us, we'll forgive you. You know, it's like if a friend of mine falls down, I'm going to help him up. But if it's somebody I don't know, if it's a traditional corporation that, you know, falls flat in their face, you know, we're going to say, aha, you know, haha for you. You don't know what you're doing. You know, the other issue too is, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, podcasts can control the message, but that's the whole issue of the entire movement is there is no longer any type of control, and you can get slammed just as easily. And I've got plenty of clients that have done things completely wrong, and it's just you look at them and say, why are you doing this? And one of them was a major podcasting issue. So it's, even though they tried to control the message, you know, spilled over the blogosphere and became an even bigger issue.
I got to come back to you, show.
I just wanted to add what Josh said. People are tired of information being force-fed to them or packaged and presented to them. That's the whole reason why a lot of this movement's taken off and accelerating. And none of my clients are blogging, but they are all at least watching or participating in some form in the blogosphere to get information, to listen. And one of my clients recently finally took the big leap for them. They were very scared to comment on a blog that had mentioned their service. And when they commented, basically saying, thank you for using our service, thank you for mentioning it in your blog, the blogger came back and said, oh, by the way, I'll probably never use your service again because it had this problem, and this problem. But at the end of that comment, he said, but thanks for listening. And so it ended with a very positive note. What my client did was went back to their product development team and said, hey, did you know that there's this problem here? We didn't know about this. We get tons and tons of feedback. This is a very large company I'm dealing with. And they get lots of feedback, but they didn't know this was a problem until they went in and said, thank you for using our product, because the problem wasn't listed on the blog. It wasn't brought up until they went in and said, thank you. And so then they went back to the comments section and said, thank you for letting us know. We've taken that to product development, and we're going to work on it now. And they look great. They're not being bashed. They look great. You will not get that in a podcast. And I'm here for podcasting. This is what it is. But we cannot discount the actual dialogue that happens.
That comment was by Sherry Heil with whataconcept.com. And, right? And that previous comment was by Josh with Haiku, HYKU.com. And remember to introduce yourselves. We had this gentleman over here next. This is being recorded and podcast.
Hey, I'm Dave Kustin with Earthlink. And I don't know, if you're a company that markets a product, I don't think there's any way you can avoid getting hammered. I mean, I don't think somehow, amen, podcasting or not, I mean, if I can create a link to your podcast, then I can trash it. I mean, and Kryptonite wasn't blogging when it was exposed that their locks sucked. So, I mean, I think the great advantage of blogging, or really anything that's, I mean, it's not about whether what software you're using or what the which tool you're using. It's, is there an opportunity for feedback? And I think the great advantage for a company is, you know, you can get into the conversation. If it's a one-way medium and you're controlling the message, when you get slammed, you don't even have a way to answer back. But if you are engaged in the blogosphere, then when the negative comments come, you can respond to them like a human being and enter a literal conversation about where it's going, and hopefully have that shape what you do and kind of the direction of things.
Yeah, I think that we're seeing PR agencies no longer control the message. I mean, it's the whole standard and the whole main, you know, the model was that PR created a message and they put it out there to media. Media broadcasted it to people and that was it, case closed. Well, anybody nowadays that's running a PR company that thinks that they can control the message really needs to rethink their entire business. The entire industry has changed. And I think nobody has taken a bigger hit, really, than the public relations industry.
I wanted to address... Oh, I did it again. I'm sorry. Penny Haynes of First Podcast Publishing. Two of you, and I know you... What was your name with Creative Loafing? Murray High. I heard a couple of things that from a geek standpoint, that seemed to be an erroneous belief that blogs, that you announce a product on a blog and it can be trashed with comments, but if you put it on a podcast, it can't. I'm living proof that that is not true because the podcast feeds are really just a blog feed with an attachment. So you can post anything and still be trashed. You don't even have to post anything and someone can trash you. So that's why, and another thing that I realized as someone was talking was it's called social media for a reason. And it has two different aspects. When you want to be seen, it's about building relationship with other people. Blogging doesn't work as an advertising strategy. The reason is you just put something out, and as who was that said, if they don't know you, if your friend falls down, you'll help them back up. And if not, if somebody just thinks that you're creating something to stuff down my throat because you want to sell something, I have no interest in it. However, the people that start offering stuff for free, free information in their area of expertise, whatever it is, and they start giving it out, that is the PR way of doing and getting your information out there, not in the standard marketing way, even with a new product or a new service. But the other thing that I wanted to point out was when it comes to businesses and doing podcasting and putting their stuff out. Oh, the train just left the station. I hate that. when they're doing that, what they're trying to do is, the way business is done now. Business is no longer in the 9-to-5 factory model that it used to be. And I read an article just yesterday in Fortune about the 100 top admired companies, businesses, and GE is number one. And they asked a gentleman there who had been there 25 years, said, what is the biggest change between when you first came and now? He says, when you first got there, there's no way basically in hell you would have ever thought you would sit down with top management. And I've been in international companies, and I know what that's like. He says, now they are looking for what the people below them, or as I say, decidedly below them, was the kind of mentality it's always been. But they're now actually having these groups where they're meeting with people in other departments. So this opening of the mind of the businesses, that there may be other ideas that are coming from outside of their top management, this is opening them up to the idea of getting feedback live from their customers as well. So if they do this kind of thing and build a business relationship and say, listen, we've got this product, there may or may not be problems with it, but we want your feedback. That's why open source is so popular. Put it out there and let everybody work on it. And everybody wants to be a part of the project. It also gives them ownership of it. So I think that a business can use podcasting and blogging in order to introduce a product or service if they have the entire mentality that we're doing this together. Give people a sense of ownership in the production of it, in the design of it, in even the grassroots marketing of it. So that's my two cents.
Let's keep this focused on media, old media versus new media, and not try to, you know, I'm sure there are other business-related workshops and sessions. Let's not get so much into corporate. Let's continue to talk about media if we could.
Yeah, hi, I'm Shelby Highsmith, the personal blog Shelbinator.com. I'm here with Young Democrats, and I thought I had nodded off and woke up in a marketing session for blogging. The thing that got me into podcasting was that I love This American Life, and I dream of one day being the next Ira Glass. And a friend of mine used to do just sort of newsroom work at a radio station. She wasn't getting the kind of attention she deserved there for her sort of text-based reporting and feeding it to the anchor people. So she went out and through the Association of Independents in Radio, saw, you know, they have a pitch page where they list all kinds of ways that public radio stations and programs, even This American Life, will solicit pitches or even fully produced audio content. And she went out and found a story about an effect, the effect of a law on migrant farm workers, and recorded it on her, you know, mini disc player and submitted it, and it got aired on national news. So, and we see also at the sort of other end of the extreme of that is CNN.com, iReport. People can send in all kinds of stuff, and it's just sort of thrown up there in a very montage kind of way. What do you see? You know, I'm willing to sort of work with traditional media saying, look, I produced this piece. I hope you like it. If you use it, great. Are media outlets going to start listening to content like that or soliciting it?
You know, I have a hard time seeing that because I don't know how receptive they're going to be to that. I do know that there were some talks at Creative Loafing about being more open to that when I was there. But at a much bigger, more bureaucratic place, I have a hard time seeing that happen. But things are changing so fast, I don't know.
It's probably headed that way. There is really, you know, there's no other, how long can they continue to pay Katie Couric $50 million a minute to sit there and say, hi, today in New Orleans there was a flood. We are all doing that. We're all saying, hi, today in New Orleans, and we're not getting $5 million a minute for it, I'm afraid. You know, that business model is just, people are going to say no. They're going to continue to demand that those kind of costs are not created in the news environment, I think. And so where are they going to get their news from? They're going to stop paying a correspondent. These people get paid gobs of money in broadcast news. And I don't know about radio and NPR, but they are paid so much money that people are doing essentially the same thing for free now. I don't want to say for free, but you take away those enormous salaries to have somebody concentrate on their hair for a good part of their package and how their lighting looks on them, and that's how we used to get our news. So much of that, you guys would not believe the amount of time these anchors and these on-camera people spend preening. They preen and they preen and they preen. We're paying, I mean, that's what the investors in these companies are paying for. Katie Couric's assistant, if you read Newser, TV Newser on Media Bistro, Katie Couric's secretary went into the newsroom, threw a huge hissy fit the other day because this is her hairdresser, because she wasn't being flown first class to Berlin with Katie. She was stuck back in coach. You know, that's what we're getting when you turn on the nightly news. That business model has got to change. It's very vanity based.
Hey, I'm Justin Davis from Davis on Draft. This is kind of related and kind of not. What do you see, and what does anybody see about new media becoming traditional media, in that, you know, podcasters turn into radio show hosts or bloggers turn into columnists, you know, I mean, as they start to get recognized for the work that they do in the new media independent realm, the traditional media kind of sucks them in and says, hey, you know, you've got a great podcast and now we want to turn that into a radio show. I mean, I could see where that may happen more in the future. I'd be interested to hear what you think about that.
I think it's already happening to a great extent. I remember one of my favorite bloggers was a guy out in California named Kevin Drum in Washington Monthly. Just hired him, and so if you type in WashingtonMonthly.com, you go to Kevin Drum's blog, and he was just an independent blogger out on the West Coast. So that's happening, and there are a lot more people are rising to the top. I mean, Josh Marshall is up in Washington, has created a whole brand. He has a lot of different sites now, so he doesn't need to be hired by somebody else. He's actually has a media empire. There's someone behind you.
My name is Len Witt, and my blog is pjnet.org for the Public Journalism Network, and I'm a professor up at Kennesaw State. And I think about all of this a lot, and I think a lot of people in the media are thinking about it. And I actually think we've reached past the point where we sit around and complain about big media, like we're doing here a lot, you know. And the idea is to try and figure out, you know, I don't know if you all know Jay Rosen and newassignment.com. And he has started a place where any of you can go today, and if you wanted to write about open source and crowdsourcing, you can go, and they're developing a story. They're working with Wired Magazine, and they're producing this big online project. It's kind of really impressive, but a lot of people are doing it. You know, Josh, like you said, is mentioning it, and I think the doors are open, and so I think what we should be doing from our side is thinking creatively. A, do we want to work with the media, or B, do we not? So if you don't want to, then you create your own thing. But if you want to, I think the days of complaining are sort of over. It's time to take some action and move in that direction and come up with some really good, solid ideas. Because they're worried, and there's a lot of opportunity now.
Hey, Dave Kustin again with Earthlink. So one question I have, I guess, is if the lines are blurring, but there is still a professional discipline that is journalism, I just wondered if anyone has experience with the big media companies, are contracts changing? Like if I get a job with with a publication, is there a way that I can preserve my ability to be a citizen journalist and to be a professional journalist under a brand at the same time? Or is that you're pretty much at your own risk at this point?
I can address the issue of, big media and network broadcasting industry is a union-controlled industry, too. I know that on a contract basis, their craftsmen, their camera people, their audio people, the editors, the people that put these shows together, their contracts were just renegotiated, and they were basically sent packing. So contracts are going away. Contracts are everything's up for negotiation right now. The unions have really controlled this environment, and they didn't get nothing when they went to the table this time. I know in one organization, that was NBC, for instance, someone said, they said, you have no control anymore over anything that's digital. It used to be, and the union people gave that away. The cameraman used to be able to control, only a union person could operate a bit of videotape, for instance. Well, now that videotape has become digitized, then it's distributed to anyone in the organization, and they can manipulate that material. So I think everything is so up for negotiation right now. Everything is negotiable, it seems like. But old media is still a union-controlled environment, and until that completely goes away, I don't know.
I wonder.
Not Atlanta. Journal Constitution doesn't have a union.
That's why their buyout's so bad.
I wanted to interject something as Mike Monitor. My name's John Noggle. I'm with Atlanta City of Peace, and our web address is atlpeace.org. Anyway, I love Grayson's comment. Everything is up for negotiation, and we're here creating something that's really wonderful at a special time in the course of human history. This is not only the first decade of a new century and the first century of a new millennium. For our organization in particular, this is the United Nations International Decade for a Culture of Peace and Nonviolence. And over 700 organizations around the world are participating in this wave of transition. And we're transitioning in the media right now. All of you guys are participating in this. So all the courageous steps you're taking right now to participate in this are setting a precedent that's going to influence generations to come. Additional comments?
Hi, I'm Catherine with Georgia for Democracy and Blog for Democracy. I cannot but think, like, I've always had a lot of respect for journalists who are trained to be journalists. Now, I'm a blogger, and I think there's a lot of bloggers here. We also have some reporters here, and I think that I honestly don't know very much about Katie Couric's actual training, but I kind of look at it like there's bloggers over here who have something to say. They may be doing it in their spare time. They're not professionals. Many of them are, but many of them are not. And then you've got the talking heads over here, like the Katie Couric's and the whoever's who may or may not be trained. But then in the middle, you've got the actual reporters who are doing the work that they've been trained to do. And I feel sometimes like I would like to just hear from them. Like, I'd like to hear from the actual people who are doing the work rather than Katie Couric, who's just reading it So I don't want to lose them. Do you understand the distinction I'm getting to?
And you know what? What I think of a reporter for the New York Times as being someone who's at the absolute top of the profession. When I look at the Iraq War, I see that Judith Miller, the reporter for the New York Times, was a propagandist for the Bush administration. The bloggers were the people telling the truth. She wasn't even telling the truth. She put lies in the paper of the New York in the pages of the New York Times, and so that unraveled. People know that because of the blogs, not because of the New York Times.
Question over here from Josh with haiku.com, H-Y-K-U.
Everybody know how to spell that now? Just a couple of just different sort of comments and questions. I mean, it kind of goes back to this whole, you know, corporate humanization type thing. It's like you can look at the AJC or you can look at a specific paper and say, boy, they don't get it if they're not doing this. But then I know three AGC reporters, and they're really cool people, and I like hanging around with them. So when you get them one-on-one, you get that human factor that comes out so many times. You know, the other issue you run into is, I always say this, journalism is an act and a profession. So a blogger can commit journalism, but they're not traditionally a journalist. And I would never call, although I run a hyperlocal blog and I do a lot of, quote, local reporting, I would never call myself a journalist, because I see that as a disservice to my friends who are professional journalists. Like me calling myself a journalist in some ways, you know, demotes some, I don't know, I hate to say that, you know, what they do for a living, because I can choose what I want to report. I can choose to maybe cover one side or not cover both sides. So it's an interesting conundrum. The other thing that's coming up, though, is, you know, the question I sort of throw out there is, what are you willing to pay for good journalism? I mean, most of us aren't really willing to pay for anything. We'll just go somewhere and look at the content we see on screen. There's some advertising which is paying the way. But one of the issues that's coming up right now is a lot of the major J schools are funded by the major journalistic institutions. And if they're going out of business or if they're dying, who's funding a lot of the programs that are going on to teach the next generation of reporters?
I paid $27.50 a month for the New York Times. I got a bunch of lies from Judith Miller back. You know, I don't know. You know, who are... What are you willing to pay?
I am Kevin Howarth, editor of TechLinks. We're a technology publication here based in Georgia. And I think, I think what's getting said a lot here, too, is that there's a lot of extreme points of view sort of being mentioned, but I think in the middle, in most publications, you know, journalists, let's say, you know, you're somewhere at a newspaper in North Carolina or you're at a magazine in Utah or something like that. I think in many cases, because it costs, you know, it does cost a lot of money to produce good journalism, is that just, I sort of view it as journalism just needs help nowadays. And I view it as more of a collaborative process. And I'll use my own publication as an example. I mean, we have to cover the Georgia technology industry, but the team is me and two part-time editors that I work with. But yet, you know, I was just sort of adding up some numbers. I realized that in our previous publication last quarter, we published 30 articles, 20 interviews, and 15 columns. How did we do that? It wasn't just me. I had to work with the community. And a lot of that is what's, quote, user-generated content. But we ask CIOs, instead of hiring experts, we ask the CIOs themselves write columns. And they write about things that are so much more precise than we could ever imagine it gets to our audience. We have community publishing articles where we ask people from the community to write articles about things that are of highest relevance to them. It gets us more precise than anything we could come up with on our own. We have to be involved with the community. We're there as a filter, as a mechanism to make it all operate and work. That's my job. But I tap the community. I get out there and I get to know who's out there to collaborate and create the journalism with us. So I see it as more of a collaborative process, and you see that it's also happening up in Greensboro, North Carolina with their newspaper where they're still a journalist outfit, but they work with the community to try to, you know, cover things that they can't cover themselves. So I see this more, I think that journalists and bloggers or the community, if you want to think of it like that, have to work together to create a better kind of journalism than we saw in the 20th century.
Great comments. Thank you. Shelby?
to kind of follow up on that in terms of working with the, you know, the community, and, you know, basically we as content creators are the community that are trying to contribute to the media. What do you think, from the old media perspective, would it enhance our ability or credibility to sort of create journalism on an ad hoc basis if we were to join a guild or form a guild, or, you know, as sort of take, you know, I imagine if you're in some sort of professional journalist society, there's a code of ethics that you sign your name to and pay dues to.
Let Leonard answer that. He's been writing on that topic a good bit. Leonard?
Leonard Witt, Kennesaw University.
There is a group that's doing that. It's the Media Bloggers Association, and they, under a guy named Robert Cox, thinks that people should be certified and actually help bloggers get in to cover the Libby trial. And he opened that up. But you sort of had to go through him first and his organization. And I've been opposed to that. I mean, I don't think anybody should be certified to be, you know, a journalist or a writer of any kind. And so that's what I keep speaking out against, because once they start giving a certification, then if any of us want to go and just do journalism, we're not a journalist. And legally and all kinds of things can begin to happen once that person is a journalist and the other person is not. It really affects the First Amendment, in my point.
One more question after this.
Murray Grievous, Creative Loafing again. I have a question, I guess it's for some of the other journalists in the room, and I know at our company, it's been mentioned or not, you mentioned just like it was earlier about, you know, collaboration, user-generated stuff, and I mean, I can tell you, and some of you probably know this, in order to do that at even an organization like Creative Loafing, which is, you know, a tenth of the size of the AJC, that would take a lot of time in editing to do that, because there's just certain things from, and Doug knows this, from the way editorial operates and the rules you have to follow, that you can't just put things up under the Creative Loafing brand, just as you can under AJC. And in my view, and like I said, I'm not a journalist, so I don't know, so I'm asking the question, you know, in order to be a vibrant, you'd have to have many, many voices within the community to help you do that. And the bigger the voices you have, the more time it's going to take to do the editing of it. Now, maybe there's a way to get away from traditional editing, but I can tell you in our newsroom, that just ain't going to happen. You know, there's just certain things you can and can't do. And, you know, until that, I guess, changes in this would be a traditional editorial deal, I don't see, you know, the investment you'd have to make in the time to get that editing done as it being, it's definitely an impediment to doing what I think some of you guys are talking about doing. And like I said, Creative Loafing is only a tenth of the size of AJC, so I can't imagine how much time it would take for them.
I was actually edited by a Cox, Washington, D.C.-based reporter for a blog entry of mine the other day. It's kind of interesting. It sort of, the two-way street started to appear. We, you know, bloggers have been putting this out, and mainstream media has been ignoring and calling bloggers horrible names. Redolent Remora Fish was the Wall Street Journal guy. Called us all Redolent Remora Fish. I love that one. Anyway, but I wrote a blog entry, and I made a glaring error. I mean, it was a horrible error. I kept writing about Bob Woodward, and I meant to write about Bob Woodruff, the injured ABC News reporter. I kept writing him, and a mainstream media reporter, he just corrected me, sent me an email. He said, didn't you mean to say Bob Woodruff, not Bob? I'm like, oh, God, yeah, you know, how could I make that mistake? But it was interesting. I was copy edited by someone in mainstream media for a blog entry. It's like, wow, that was some interesting little action, a little tiny kind of glimmer of something happening there.
One more question. Anybody?
This is Worth Bishop with 2 Cents Media. The comment my friend at TechLinks made a minute ago was so right on there, but I think you missed it almost entirely. The value is in the filtration system. We used to have media, the old media, we had value in the media, the paper, the delivery systems, all that kind of cool stuff. Well, we don't need the paper, the delivery trucks. We don't need that anymore. We do need,
and we'll pay for the filtration system, if I can believe it. But if you impeach yourself, like the New York Times, and don't immediately do a mea culpa and get rid of the problem, your filtration value has gone to zero. The web as it is, the blogosphere, whatever you want to call it, has no filtration system. And so 98% of what I, well, it's my own eyeballs. My own eyeballs is all there is.
I just gave you an example of how I was checked the mail by a number one.
Doug.
This guy named Bob Darts works for the newspapers out of Washington.
Well, it's, you know, everything's up for interpretation right now. It's just
well, I think we're out of time. It's time for lunch. Thank you all so much. And I think what you're talking about is the old editor role. And anyway, thanks, everybody, and time to eat.
The song you heard in this podcast was Garden by Cargo Cult, available only on Magnatune.com. Thanks for listening to Unconcast on the Georgia Podcast Network. If you have recorded or are planning to record a discussion that you think would make a good episode of Unconcast, email us at info@gapodcastnetwork.com to learn how you can submit it.